Rolling here on a Turbo Tuesday edition of the program. David Murata is the president of Murata Wealth Management and joins us regularly here on the program for years and years. A great source of information and also a rational voice in times of distress. And I would say we're kind of in a time of distress right now regarding the markets. David, welcome back to the Shilling Show, and thank you for being with us today. Oh, hold on. Let me figure it out. Okay, you got number four.
Thank you so much for having
me.
There
we go. All right.
What an exciting time in the markets.
Well, to put it mildly, I'm sure a lot of people would rather not have exciting time. I got to ask you, because this is what you do for a living. You are a financial advisor. So did this surprise you, or were you in anticipation mode for this big drop?
You know, people have been expecting a drop since the drop in the end of 2018 when the markets went down 19.8%, just shy of a bear market. And then everyone was expecting 2019 to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And of course, 2019 did great. And so a lot of people get very worried about the markets and they say, well, it can't go up forever, can it? But actually, if you look at the last 200 years, that's what the market does. It just goes up forever, albeit with a couple of crashes and several bear markets and tons of corrections that are down 10%. So the market is like the tip of a whip, and someone is cracking the whip up and down and up and down. But the person cracking the whip is on an escalator that's gradually going up. And so in the short term, the markets are all over the place. They're incredibly volatile. In the long term, though, they're incredible engines of wealth production, and the long term is, you know, the longer term you get, the less volatile the market returns are, the more consistent they are. So, you know, any particular decade, your odds of the market being up are like 94%. Any year, the odds of the market being up are 73%. And any 20-year period, I believe the odds of the market being up in a 20-year period are 100%. I don't think we've ever had a 20-year period where the markets have been down. So so the markets in the short term are very volatile, but in the long term are very profitable. And we just had a recent peak on February 19th, 2020. The S&P 500 reached a peak. It wasn't that long ago. And it took 6 trading days after that peak for it to go down 10%. That's the fastest the market's ever gone down from peak to down 10%, 6 days. You know, the previous record, I think, was 7. You know, so it's not out of what the market does, but I think that got everyone's attention. And I think people were looking for a little bit of reasons to panic. And the coronavirus is a great narrative. Robert Schuller, who's won the Nobel Prize in Economics, has a new book called Economic Narratives, in which he talks about how narratives are so much more important than facts to the way the market works. The market works and the economies work based a lot on narratives, and whether the narrative is true or not doesn't really matter. In his book, he talks about the narrative of automation replacing workers and putting people out of business. And he takes that throughout history, and he going all the way back to the Luddites, and he does the different names that have been used. Automation is the most recent name. Artificial intelligence is the one that's now rising.
What are some of the previous ones throughout history?
There was one on robotics and one on mechanization. If you keep going back in time, they just call it by different things. And it used to be a lot of, well, it's going to put people out of business, or it's going to make people unemployed because look at all the farm workers that will be displaced by the tractor. And it's true. We move on to other industries and we find other things to do. And I think automation is a wonderful thing. Every time I find something in our business that we can automate, I think to myself, we've got plenty of other work to do. There's other things that we can be doing to bring value to clients and customers that doesn't involve things that can be automated. And anything that can be automated is a good thing, not a bad thing, because it makes us more productive.
You know, from your own professional point of view, I think a lot of people would be curious about how your day-to-day changes in a situation like this. In other words, do you go on like a 24-hour work cycle? Are your jobs and tasks increased? Or is it basically business as usual? I'm not saying you're ignoring what's going on, but as you said, you've kind of been prepared for things along the way. So how does it affect you and your business in providing service?
Yeah, it's interesting. Back in 2015, I wrote an article, What to Do When the Stock Market Drops 1,800 Points. This is 2015, so it's been a while. It's been 5 years.
Yeah.
But I was quoting Barry Glassman, and he in his letter to his clients, he said, "At Glassman Wealth, our plan is to do nothing." That doesn't mean that we haven't been preparing our portfolios all along. It means we're not going to panic when the time comes. And, I think that's a really important thing to happen. He goes on to say, "I'm not going to guess whether the next move in the markets is 10% up or down. I just know at some point a correction will come. And when it does, an 1,800-point drop will feel terrible, and the news will be covering it 24/7. So he was exactly right. That's what happens. The downturn in the market yesterday in a single day was down 7.6%. Mm-hmm. That's a large drop. We haven't had a drop like that since 2008. But if you take all the days in history that the market goes down 7.6% or more, one comes along about every 4 years. So in 2008, we had four of them, and that covered 16 years worth of those kinds of days. We just had another one, and you know that's a normal day in the market. It's not unusual. It's not even a crazy day in the market. You know, the craziest day in the market, the worst day in the market ever, was back in October 19th of 1987.
Black Friday.
Black Monday, actually.
Black Monday.
The S&P 500 lost 20.47% in a single day.
What precipitated that? I remember it happening, but I don't remember the details. We've got about a minute here before we go out.
You know, there were all kinds of things that were suggested. It was suggested that automation was the culprit or automatic selling or trading or stuff. Mm-hmm. In truth, when something turns like that, the market can move very quickly on very little trading if all of the trading is selling.
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't understand how the market works, but the market goes down when there are more sellers than buyers, and the market goes up when there are more buyers than sellers. And you say, well, you know, every time there's someone sells something, someone has to be buying it. But that's not exactly true, because it's not the way a market works. For every stock on the New York Stock Exchange, there is a market maker.
When we come back on the other side, because I want to spend some time here, because I think most people don't understand that or even know that there are these market makers there.
Yeah, once you understand how the market works, you know that the market can't go to zero.
Okay, we're going to get to that on the other side. David Morata is our guest. If you have comments, questions, fears about what's going on with the market, hey, we'd love to hear from you, and we'll get to that on the other side. 977-1070. That's the magic number, 434-977-1070. Comments, questions, challenges for David Morata. We're talking about market instability in 2020 and what you should or shouldn't be doing, and maybe a little peace of mind here as we look historically and put this into context. All right, The Shilling Show will be back on the other side of news and weather. Stay with us. Get it all off my mind, and like a memory from your grandpa's attic, a song comes slipping through the radio static, changing my mood. A little George Strait in 1982, and the world turns. All right, The Shilling Show continues here. We're talking about market instability, volatility, 2020, the big drop that took place, 2013 points. And so I wanted to spend some time for people to understand the market, because quite frankly, I don't remember ever learning this until I knew you, the concept of market makers. Who are they and what do they do?
Yeah, once you understand how the New York Stock Exchange works and how a market is made, it's actually very comforting, because mm-hmm. you realize that the market can't go to zero. And you also realize why the market has volatility. As an aside, I had someone ask me, why doesn't the government just make it so the market goes up a little bit each day with no volatility? And I thought, wow, you don't understand economics at all, do you? But the way a market maker works, the interesting part of this story for me is that I found out my grandfather was a market maker. He worked for a market maker on the stock market exchange. He started in March of 1929. Mm-hmm. He was there during the crash, and he kept his job, I think, until 1931, and then lost it because there just wasn't enough work to do. Mm-hmm. But for every stock on the New York Stock Exchange, there's at least one company that acts as a market maker, and for the big companies, there's often several. And what a market maker does is they have a big pile of that company's stock, and when someone wants to buy stock and no one who owns the stock wants to sell it, then the market maker will sell the stock out of their inventory. And there's always an amount at which they will sell. There's a slightly lower amount at which they will buy, and that's the bid-ask spread. Mm-hmm. So if there's more people who want to sell than want to buy, they're obligated to buy it at the lower price. And after a certain number of shares trade, they're allowed to move the price down if there's still no other buyers. And so if people are selling and no one is buying, the market maker has to buy, but the market maker is allowed to move the stock price down. There's rules on how they can do that. When it goes down low enough, then people say, wow, this stock is a deal. Mm-hmm. I want to buy this stock. And now the buyers and sellers are trading between the bid-ask spread. And then if the buyers want to continue to buy and there's no more sellers, then the market maker will begin to buy back the stock and they'll move the stock price up. So the difficulty that we have now is that the market sentiments, the market emotions are all the way on terror or fear, mm-hmm. and people are selling because they're thinking, oh, this is another 2008, it's going to go down 50%, this is terrible. And so when there's more sellers, the market makers just move the price down, and they move the price down so long as there are more sellers than buyers. But as they move it down, the stock becomes more and more attractive, and you can imagine if it was trying to move to zero, and it was trying to approach zero, that would mean that David Murata with his pocket change could buy every single stock on the New York Stock Exchange, and I'd own the world. Well, long before I could do that, Warren Buffett wakes up one morning and he says, this is a buying opportunity. Mm-hmm. We've dipped, 18-19%. So I'm just going to buy some stock because I think this is a great time to be buying stocks because the market is down that much. And so the market can't go to zero. As it drops, it will find some resistance at which people like Warren Buffett or even like David Murata will look and say, well, I'm going to sell some of my bonds and buy some of my stocks because at this price, stocks look really attractive. What's happened in the market is people have sold their stocks and bought bonds, mm-hmm. and they have so bid up the bonds that bonds are now not paying very good interest because they've actually pushed up the bond price. With the price so high, the interest that they pay is a smaller percent, and a lot of the bonds now are paying less than 1%.
Wow.
Simply because people have fleed from stocks and into bonds.
So help us to understand who's funding the market makers, and are they supervised by government oversight? It's such a gray area to me, and I still don't understand exactly how that works.
You apply to be a market maker. There's a set of rules that you abide by, but market makers make their money on the difference between the bid and ask spread. And if you think about in olden times, you used to see stock market tickers, and it would always be like 1 1/8. Mm-hmm. It would always be in like fractions.
I remember.
Of 1/8. Well, 1/8 is 12.5 cents, and that used to be the smallest bid-ask spread that you would ever get, was 12.5 cents. With today's electronics and market makers, the bid-ask spread is sometimes a fraction of a penny, but they make a tremendous amount of money on that fraction of a penny because every time the market moves up and then down and then up and then down, they're making a little tiny bit on the bid-ask spread because they're selling it on the high side and they're buying it on the low side. Mm-hmm. And as they buy it, they move it down further. And as they sell it, they move it up. And so they're making more money the more times that they're engaged, and they're costing them less the more time that they're having to buy. So yeah, market makers make a lot of money. And that's why with a company like Apple, there's probably a dozen market makers who are all competing for that same business, that tiny little bid ask spread.
It sounds a lot like supply and demand. Is that a good comparison to what goes on with setting market prices?
Yes. And it makes an orderly market. One of the things that happened yesterday is actually they suspended supply and demand. They actually stopped the market for about 15 minutes. When the market stops, no one knows what a stock costs or what it's worth. And that is sometimes when you can get a free fall plunge. We had that several years ago in what was called the flash crash. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember that, but the flash crash, the market prices dropped 60-70%. And then came right back up within the hour. And they did that because the market was suspended. And when market makers are suspended, There's lots of people who go and they put a tiny little bid out there. They say, I'll buy this for a nickel. And they know it's not worth a nickel, but what they get back is the real price. And the real price is maybe $120 a share. Well, when market makers aren't there to answer it, they say, I'll buy this for a nickel. And people who have put a market order out there to sell for whatever I can get sold for a nickel.
Oh, man.
So the New York Stock Exchange went back and invalidated those, but they said down 60% was okay, down 100% was not. And so a lot of people sold something down 60% only to buy it, only to have it come right back up again within minutes once they had started the market back up. So suspending the market, I think, is almost always a bad idea. And the fact that they suspended it yesterday, I think, contributed to the downturn in the market yesterday being one, you know, sort of that was a lot larger than it could have been.
There's been discussion also in past years, and I don't remember if it surrounded the flash crash that you referenced, that there is market manipulation of people putting in big orders in order to kind of manipulate the market or distort the market. Do we have anything to fear, particularly from foreign entities that may be playing games?
Yeah, I don't think there are games that you can play with the market rules where you can make money. If you flood the market by selling stock, you're just driving the price down for what you're selling it for. And if you bid the market up because you're buying something and the market moves up, you're paying more every time you buy something. So although there's a lot of talk about market manipulation among conspiracy theorists, I really can't see that there's much of that going on because most of it is counterproductive to what you'd be trying to do.
Let's talk about the COVID-19 fears. Is this the reason why people are selling or some component of it?
Yeah, I think that people think, somewhat rightly so, the best rational narrative you can put to it is that because of the virus, supply chains will be interrupted, events will be canceled, travel will be down. And if you look at the cruise lines, they were down about 50%. Carnival Cruise Line and Royal Caribbean were down a lot. If you look at the airlines, they're hurting. In fact, in the six-day slide, there was only about 8 stocks that were up. One of them was Clorox. Clorox is going to have a bumper year. I'm sure they can't put that stuff out fast enough. You know, so all of the toilet paper and hand wipes and all that, they're going to have a good year. You know, I saw hand sanitizer was, you know, going for $150 for a little kind of tiny container just because people were trying to say, look, if you really want this stuff, you're going to have to pay for it because everybody wants this stuff. And you know, I think that's actually good. It's a good way to regulate it.
I want to ask you about this because there are laws against what they call price gouging. And I think we've had the conversation before, but when the prices go up, doesn't that help to flood the market with people wanting to sell that good and then normalize the market?
It does. If hand sanitizer goes up enough, I'll sell my unopened bottle and you know, back onto the market if I don't need it. So yes, I actually think the laws that are trying to limit prices in an emergency are counterproductive. It would be much better to allow, you know, in a hurricane, if you allow bottled water to be $5 a bottle rather than $1 a bottle, that means that people who have bottled water will be trucking it into places that need it and paying extra expense simply because there's a profit to be made there. And that profit does more than, you know, all the government relief you could do in order to satisfy something because that's a great incentive for the entire country to be trying to deliver the good that's needed.
So we've got a minute here before the break. So why are people so scared of the market? In other words, why do people feel in government they have to intervene if they're putting in, you know, a market stop, or if people are saying, hey, we're going to ban, you know, exorbitant pricing and price gouging? Why don't we trust the market? It has a proven record.
Yeah, there's a narrative that I hear quite frequently from prospective clients who come in. They say something along the lines, well, you know, my friend lost everything in 2008 and still hasn't recovered. And I think to myself, the only way that you can lose everything in 2008 and not have recovered would have been if you sold at the bottom and you just never got back in. And that's the difficulty with jumping out of the markets is I can always give you great reasons to jump out of the markets, but I can never give you the right timing to jump back in. So most people who get out of the markets near the bottom. And most people who get back into the markets get back into the markets at a higher rate than when they got out. So they're almost always losing money that way. You know, currently the market is down between 10 and 20%. The S&P 500 trades, you know, the S&P 500 is setting a new high only about 6% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
94% of the time it's trading down from some prior peak. And 54% of the time it's trading down 10% or more from some prior peak. And actually, if you look at since 1928, the S&P 500 has been in bear market territory. I mean, it's down 20% mm-hmm. from some prior peak about 39% of the time, which is huge. Now, since 1950, it's been a little bit better. It's only in bear market territory about 22% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We're not yet in bear market territory, but right on the edge of that. Mm-hmm. And bear markets are not anything to be worried about either. I've got a whole series of blog posts on our website on every bear market in history. And it goes down, then it reaches down more than 20%, then it might go a little bit further down, and then it recovers and goes back up. And usually once it's down 20%, the forward returns are phenomenal because it's only got up to go at that point. And while we can define a bear market as down 20% from some prior high, we can't define up from some prior low. Because the prior lows just go back further in history, 200 years. You know, it's up an infinite amount from the prior low 200 years ago. So there is nothing that you can measure for a bull market other than a bull market is the time between bear markets. So the minute a bear market bottoms, that starts the next bull market. And who knows how much it's going to go up, but it's probably going to be going up more than the bear market went down because on average, the markets trend upward.
We've got one segment left. We're talking with David Murata, Murata Wealth Management, on market volatility and stability and whether or not you ought to be in panic mode. I hope you're getting the gist of things that you shouldn't be. But we're going to conclude the conversation on the other side. Comments and questions at 977-1070. Shilling Show returns in just a moment. Right into the final segment this hour of the Shilling Show. David Murata joins us, Murata Wealth Management. We're talking about the market volatility and instability and how people ought to react to this and putting it into historical context, which is always most important. All right, so let's go here to the market, new highs, and then kind of finding the floor from there. What is the window of time in which that generally happens?
Yeah, as we said before the break, the market is only making new highs about 6% of the time, and then it bounces around. It bounces up, it bounces down, and it bounces sideways. Mm. And finally, at some point, it bounces above that new high again. I did an analysis once, and I found out that when it sets a new high, it crosses that line 57 times on average, going up and down and up and down and up and down. And it takes about 5.5 years before it finally crosses it one more time on the upside, never to go below it again. So that's why a lot of investment advisors and financial planners will say, if you need the money in the next 5 years, it probably shouldn't be in stocks because who knows where it's going to be. It's going to be bouncing around quite a lot. And you should probably have 5 to 7 years of whatever withdrawals you need from your portfolio in bonds. So, you know, if you want to prepare for a coming downturn, you should not only have toilet paper, but you should also have 5 to 7 years in bonds so that you do not have to sell your stocks when the market is down. In fact, as we've been suggesting, one of the very wrong things to do is to sell stocks when they're down. So having that 5 to 7 years of, say, spending in bonds means that you're really investing in the stock market for 8 years and longer.
Mm-hmm.
And the stock market in 7 years, one standard deviation of stock market movements in 7 years is all positive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the good news, is that most of the time you're going to get a positive return over 7 years. So you have 6 years in bonds, 5.5, you know, years for the market to be bouncing around. That all works very well. If you do have all of that and you've prepared, because that's what I think was meant by Barry Glassman of we've already prepared for that because we have the right amount of money in bonds. If you've already prepared for that, then the correct thing to do is to rebalance your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And rebalancing your portfolio is a natural result of setting an asset allocation first. Most investors don't set an asset allocation. In fact, a lot of financial advisors don't set a target asset allocation. But setting a target asset allocation and rebalancing back to it gives you a rebalancing bonus, because you'll sell what's up, you'll buy what's down. And then when things move again, of the things that are down are more likely to go up, and the things that are up are more likely to go down in comparison. And that natural act of rebalancing is always contrarian, and following the herd is almost always the wrong answer, and being a contrarian is almost always the right answer. So we have a saying within the firm: it's always a good time to have a balanced portfolio. It keeps us sane in these markets, and we're busy rebalancing client portfolios on a regular basis. And when clients call, we tell them we think it's always a good time to have a balanced portfolio. And when in doubt, the correct thing to do is to rebalance your portfolio. When stocks are up and you rebalance your portfolio, you'll sell stocks and buy bonds. When stocks are down and you rebalance your portfolio, you'll sell some bonds and you'll buy stocks. Now's a great time to sell some bonds, because they've been bid up in price. And they're doing great, and the interest they're paying is not very good. Now's a great time to be buying stocks, because the stock market is down. I don't know if we're at the exact bottom, but I'm pretty sure we're at the bottom of what will be the stock market maybe 5.5 years from now. So if the stock market hit a new high in February of 2020, it might be August of 2025 when it gets back to that new high to cross it on the upside and never go below it again. And so that's the range of time. Sometime between now and 2025, the market will have more than fully recovered and be doing great. And the stock market is down about 20%, so it should be up 20% by then, never to go below that again.
We have a quick email question from Bill. Could you please comment on high-speed trading? It seems quite unfair to allow high-speed traders to set up servers physically close to exchanges for the purpose of getting a speed advantage over ordinary buyers and sellers, and I've got about a minute for you to take that on.
Yeah, a lot is criticized for people of high-speed trading, and there's even a movie about, you know, trying to set up even closer to that. The money that used to be able to be made in high-speed trading is not able to be made quite as much because there's so many people competing for that service. It does provide a service to the market. So, for example, if you have the New York Stock Exchange and you have the NASDAQ, and you have a stock that's trading on both of them, say Apple is trading on both of them, that means that if the price of Apple is slightly higher on one stock exchange and slightly lower on the other one, people will buy Apple on one stock exchange and sell it on the other to make those prices equal. It's sort of like importing spice from China. You're buying it where it's low and you're selling it where it's high. And that does provide a service. It provides a little bit more accurate pricing on both stock exchanges. And what are they making off of that? They're making fractions and fractions of a penny. It's a very small amount, because there's so many people competing for that business that it's very difficult to do. But it does provide a pricing service, so I think they're doing a little tiny bit of work. It's not zero work that they're doing. They're also providing a tremendous amount of liquidity to the markets, and high-speed trading providing liquidity does provide another service. It means there's a lot more trades to keep pricing a lot more accurate.
David Marotta, you've provided a great service to our audience today and brought probably some financial peace to people and calm, so well needed in these days of volatility. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And he's online at marottaonmoney.com.